deployment of nuclear weapons. The U.S. has conducted several missions to South Korea involving so-called strategic assets, weapons that can deliver nuclear bombs. Amid the South Korea-U.S. military buildup, civil society leaders meeting in Seoul this week called on President Yoon to make greater efforts to pursue dialogue with North Korea. Under the previous progressive president, Moon Jae-in, engagement with North Korea reduced tensions, which have only flared up again with the election of President Yoon and renewed North Korean missile tests in 2022. South Korean peace activists say 2023, the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War armistice, marks an occasion to increase their campaign to officially end the war. Meanwhile, President Yoon plans to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the South Korea-U.S. alliance with record-level military exercises. Frank Smith, Seoul.
They took months to be held, but only hours to fail. Negotiations between unions and the UK government aimed at working out mainly pay deals to prevent another wave of public sector disruptions.
We are talking about people who are working well beyond their contracted hours anyway, just to get the job done, because they can't hand patients over and because they care so much. So for the government to be talking about productivity in exchange for a pay award is an insult to every single one of our members.
An insult to his union members and perhaps to other public sector workers across the country, protesting against the government's refusal to give them pay rises that keep pace with inflation, which soared above 10% in October last year. The same month, public sector pay in real terms hit a 19-year low.
Brexit has destroyed investment. It's led to us being a less attractive place for foreign direct investment as well. So, unfortunately, we've got a lot of self-inflicted wounds, plus Ukraine, plus, you know, fairly incompetent government.
But the government is digging in. Instead of making concessions, it has introduced controversial new legislation to Parliament designed to curb the impact of the strikes. Critics of the new bill are warning of the consequences.
Once you start sacking people, people are more likely to even go on strike together. I mean, ultimately, this is so much against the trade union movement, they risk a national strike over it, because trade unions will gang together to make sure that they have an impact and stop this kind of legislation.
Without the desired pay offers from the government, those walkouts are bound to go ahead, with tens of thousands of transport workers, National Health Service staff, civil servants and others set to take part in industrial action this month and beyond.
There are more strikes in the UK today than in more than a decade, driven by a cost of living crisis and a lack of inflation-matching pay rises. The unions are saying enough is enough, and that the only way for them to cease further industrial action is hard, cold cash. It remains to be seen if the UK government will be the first one to blink in this staring contest. Saeed Purizep, London.
Families of prisoners and their advocates have staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails and detention centers. Tel Aviv practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, and Al-Quds. Among those apartheid policies is the bad treatment of Palestinian prisoners.
The prisoners are suffering tremendously inside Zionist jails, and we pray for their release. My son was only 17 when he was arrested and has been behind bars since 1992. He's a freedom fighter who fought for the liberation of Al-Quds and Palestine.
Palestinian prisoners who are held in 24 Israeli jails and detention centers are all denied basic human rights.
Prisoners' advocacy groups are calling on the international community to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its grave violations against Palestinian prisoners.
Meanwhile, a workshop was held in the blockaded territory on how to tackle the dangers posed by right-wing Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir on Palestinian prisoners. The workshop was organized by Hamas's Wa'id Prisoners Society and the Islamic Jihad's Mujahid al-Quds Foundation for Prisoners. Attendees discussed ways of confronting threats by the extremist Israeli minister.
It's our duty to protect and fight for Palestinian prisoners amid the ongoing attempts by Ben-Gavir and the Zionist entity to pass a law that allows the execution of Palestinian prisoners as well as the deportation of Palestinian prisoners. We are facing a big Zionist project targeting not only the prisoners but also all aspects of Palestinian existence.
For decades, the Israeli regime has violated all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention.
The issue of Palestinian prisoners is at the core of the Palestinian cause. They are held in Zionist jails because they fought for the freedom of Palestine and have kept the Palestinian cause alive. Palestinian prisoners have played a major role in fighting the Zionist project that aims to empty Palestine of its indigenous Palestinian population.
Palestinians are calling on the international community to break their silence and help Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
We will not be beaten. This is the title of a newly released documentary produced by Press TV. The documentary has been made based on 5,000 minutes of footage and documents collected and released by the U.S. media regarding domestic violence against women and the violation of women's rights in the United States. We Will Not Be Beaten tells the documented story of the high rate of domestic violence and physical abuse against women in the U.S.
This documentary, ordered by Press TV, has been made based on 5,000 minutes of footage and documents regarding violation of women's rights and violence against women, which have been collected and released by the U.S. media. Also, in order to have a better understanding of the situation in the United States, we have interviewed many people who have been living in the U.S. for 10 to 20 years.
According to official statistics, there are more than 20,000 phone calls placed to domestic violence hotlines in the U.S. every day. Moreover, one in every three women in the U.S. experience rape and physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime.
This documentary has shown the realities regarding violation of women's rights and domestic violence against women in the United States. It shows that the only thing that the U.S. does not care about is the rights of women. One example is the U.S. proposed resolution which led to the ouster of Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women. The production of such documentaries will further shed light on the double standards policies of Washington with regard to women's rights.
While Western media outlets have launched a propaganda against Iran with regard to the status of women, we have released a new documentary titled We Will Not Be Beaten to depict the true status of women in the U.S. As Press TV has been the voice of the voiceless, we have made our efforts to be the voice of the rising number of American women who are facing domestic violence and physical abuse on a daily basis.
Domestic violence against women has seen an alarming uptick in recent years in the United States, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. A report by the Council on Criminal Justice found that reports of domestic violence in the U.S. have jumped by over 8% during the pandemic lockdown.
As Press TV documentary has shown, the high rate of violence against women in the U.S. has been recognized as a public health concern, with media in the U.S. contributing to making domestic violence appear unimportant to the public. Experts say given such realities on the ground, the U.S. cannot serve as a role model for women's rights in the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
United States President Joe Biden has visited the Mexican border for just the first time in his presidency. An estimated 8,000 asylum seekers cross the Texas border every day, with last year breaking records.
Official data showed that the number of undocumented immigrant crossings at the southwest border reached 2.8 million people, breaking the annual record by more than 1 million.
In yet another major expansion of a policy of Donald Trump, which the Democratic Party criticized for years, Biden announced the U.S. will immediately deport even more new arrivals. Biden has also drastically increased the number of deportations from the Trump era. The United States accepts fewer refugees per capita than almost any other Western nation, and the world's wealthiest country refuses to provide adequate resettlement and border services.
Let's not forget that the Biden administration still is running the very same for-profit internment camps on the southern border that are full of immigrants. When Trump was president, there was rightfully a lot of criticism of these policies. These are not just holding cells or whatever. These are basically internment camps where large numbers of immigrants, including families and children, are held.
Rarely discussed in the mainstream media is that U.S. foreign policy has played a major role in the Western Hemisphere's long-running refugee crisis. Instead, both the media and Biden's immigration policy give special priority to asylum seekers leaving socialist-inspired nations, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua.
Encouraging them to leave these countries that have socialist governments. And then, of course, the U.S. government says, look at these people fleeing so-called communism. It's exactly what the Biden administration's spokespeople have been saying. It's basically, right-wing Cold War-style propaganda. And the reality is that these people are not fleeing. These people are going to the United States because the U.S. is telling them, we're going to give you visas.
2022 saw seemingly the entire West accused of racism due to their privileging of refugees from Ukraine over non-white asylum seekers. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The Israeli regime has started the year 2023 on a bloody note. Barely 2 weeks into the new year, Israeli forces have killed 9 Palestinians, 5 of them in a span of only 2 days since Wednesday. And among the victims are 3 Palestinian minors. Tel Aviv's land grab policy with demolition of Palestinian homes also continues unabated. In tonight's Spotlight program, we'll try to shed more light on the deteriorating condition that the Palestinians are facing. Our guests tonight are Mohsen Naghvi, human rights activist, joining us from Houston, Texas. And we also have attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmad Tamaya joining us from Johannesburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Narvi in Houston. Tensions remain high across the West Bank with the Israeli military stepping up its raids. So far this year, as we mentioned in our intro, 9 Palestinians have been killed. How do you view the recent wave of violence against Palestinians carried out by the Israeli regime?
Well, this is exactly what's expected off of this new regime. They have escalated the atrocities that they've been committed for years. This time around, they're using the pretext of wanted Palestinians, and that's how they're trying to justify their raids that they are doing, in which they recently killed Samir Oniharbi, who was simply protecting his son from being arrested during these raids, and he was shot, brutally shot in the chest, and he was surrounded by Israeli soldiers and was brutally killed. This is exactly the policy of the new Israeli regime. Ben-Gavir is leading the new government, and this is what is expected of this new government. A 17-year-old girl was killed because she simply retaliated while her house was being demolished. Israel, we see a huge increase in settlement activities, which is in clear violation of the Oslo Accords. It's quite clear that this new government doesn't respect international law. It is clear that this new government wants to escalate the tensions that already exist between Palestinians and the Israelis. And it's quite clear that they want to occupy West Bank in its entirety.
Mr. Mayet, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned Israel's constant crimes, stressing that the martyrs' blood will not go in vain, and the Israeli measures ultimately will only strengthen Palestinians' resolve to continue their resistance against the regime. Are these Israeli crimes, in your opinion, making Palestinians more united in the face of the occupation? And is that something that the Israelis are worried about, a united Palestinian resistance front, all groups and parties uniting against the occupation?
Most definitely. I think the greatest fear of the Israeli regime is the united Palestinian movement, and this has already manifested itself post Saif al-Quds. What is also becoming problematic is that there's a regional configuration that has taken place, where you see that there is support from movements such as Hezbollah in Lebanon. You see even support reaching far down as Yemen with Ansarullah, and as far to the east as Hashd al-Shaabi from Iraq. The definite unity that has been presenting itself is in the form of Lion's Den. If you look at the Israeli assessments, they cannot pin particular individuals to specific organizations. What is very clear is that this is an amalgamation of numerous organizations. You see numerous of the shuhada, the martyrs, their bodies being covered in different flags, from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which was formed by George Habash, which is a Marxist secularist movement, yet they have a religious connection. The latest martyr had a will where he says that he wants to die as a shaheed. This you see aligning with Hamas, and one of the other martyrs most recently was shrouded in a Hamas flag. So you see this principle of the unification of the fronts, and this is precisely what the Abbas regime under the Palestinian Authority fears, as they have become the enforcers of the Israeli state. What you do see is that there's an increasing support from the Palestinians, and this is not my own assessment. This is from Israeli sources for the armed resistance movement. And this is what we are seeing now. We're seeing an escalation to an inevitable end, and that is a full-scale war where the red lines will have to be crossed by Israel, which is being crossed, and will inevitably lead to the dismantlement of the state.
Mossad Avi, there are a number of reprisal attacks against Israelis, some that even took place in the heart of Tel Aviv. Now, the occupied city of Jenin, for one, has recently been the focus of the Israeli aggression following a series of anti-Israeli operations there by Palestinians. Give us your perspective on the significance of these operations, as it seems Palestinians are venting their anger at the regime's crimes and occupation.
Sayyid Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, has gone on to praise these operations in one of his speeches. He talks about them in detail. What other options do you expect the Palestinians to have? They have tried every measure possible. International courts of justice have failed to provide any justice to Palestinians. The Israelis are constantly in violation of international law. They constantly commit these crimes, and the innocent stone-throwing Palestinian will eventually have to retaliate. And they're taking their inspiration from resistance forces like Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad. This is exactly how Hezbollah also started retaliating against the Israeli regime, and it worked. And it is clearly working now as well. I mean, Israel has been forced to push a government that is being run by a fascist called Ben-Gavir. We have never seen such issues within the Knesset before. Israeli ministers are asking the opposition to be arrested, who was an ex-Israeli prime minister, Lapid. So we haven't seen these things before. It's quite clear that the Zionist regime is very vulnerable. It's never been this vulnerable before. And as the brother mentioned, we see forces such as the Lions then emerging now from the West Bank, who are fighting for their right, which is also within within the ambit of international law. They are simply defending themselves. And these activities that are being taken place by the Palestinians are in defense, not in offense. So it's praiseworthy, and this shows that they don't have many options but to fight back and retaliate with the limited means that they possess.
Mr. Mayed, Hamas reiterated that resistance against the occupying Israeli regime is a legitimate right. Hamas and Islamic Jihad have both said Israel is responsible for the repercussions of its aggression. Observers and analysts at this point are saying that we could be looking at the prelude for a third intifada. What's your take on that?
I think the third intifada has already begun. When you look at the escalations in various theaters, we look at Gaza, you look at what happened in the West Bank, what happens within Israel proper, you see an escalation across the board. And this is precisely what you referred to in the very beginning with regards to the unification and exactly what my fellow panelist has just spoken about, the vulnerability of the state of Israel. Yes, it's an international law, right? It was exercised here in South Africa as well with the armed movement of Umkhonto weSizwe and many other factions when the late first president of South Africa, Nelson Mandela, stated that many believe that it is futile to continue to speak about nonviolence when the regime's answer is only savage attacks. This is precisely what we are seeing with Israel. Israel has gone so far as to elect one of the most right-wing governments that it ever had, Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. These individuals are clearly off the cliff. They're not even on the spectrum. They have really indicated to everyone, including the U.S. administration, that they are prepared to take Israel to the brink of a war. This is what we are seeing now. We're seeing mass escalations across the board. And what we are actually seeing now is that Israel is cornered. If you look at the situation, Israel is trying to confine its activities to the West Bank with something that they refer to as security or operations, which is nothing more than an attempt to try and pacify their own population, whereas they are trying very hard not to escalate within Gaza as well as the Northern Front. Israel is weak. It is a glorified police state and has to resort to draconian measures to assert its deterrence, which has failed ever since 2006. It's a failed state. We are heading to a situation where Israel is talking about post-Abbas, post the Palestinian Authority, meaning that their enforcer is going to be lost on the ground. It only spells disaster for Israel. They need to be like the apartheid regime. Read the writing on the wall. It's over. There is no space for Zionism in the current world. There's no space for racism. There's no space for apartheid. It's time for this regime to read that writing, if they can read.
Mr. Na'vi, on the issue of resistance, which you also spoke about a few minutes ago, an analyst that we spoke to here on Press TV believes that the Palestinians have every right to fight the Israeli occupation and that they should be supported in their struggle. Now, the question here is, do you believe Palestinians are receiving the support they need, and how can that support be enhanced?
Well, Israel receives $10.5 million a day in military aid by the U.S. government. In comparison to that, Palestinians don't receive anything. Even the Arab states have failed to support the Palestinians in any way whatsoever. May that be diplomatically or in terms of funding them militarily. The only power that we see that has supported the Palestinian resistance forces, and this is coming from Islamic Jihad and from the leadership of Hamas, is the Islamic Republic of Iran under the leadership of Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The one person who is single-handedly responsible for enhancing resistance activities against the Zionist regime was Sheikh Qasem Soleimani. And I believe it is this very reason that Ben-Gavir, in his failed attempt to create some kind of a symbol, stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the date of his Shahadat, which was January 3rd. So as the brother also mentioned, this is all, as Rabbi mentioned, that Israel doesn't have more than 25 years. And Sayyid Nasrullah goes on to say that it may be less than 25 years that we see the end of the Zionist regime. Its very existence is unnatural in that region. It is only to an extent that oppression can sustain itself when you have people who are ready to give their lives for their freedom. I mean, they are arresting children. They are arresting kids under the ages of 12 under the military rule that they have in West Bank. 12-year-old kids, they are detained for an average of 2 years without any trial. So this kind of oppression has not been seen in history in the past. Yes, it is in comparison to the apartheid of South Africa. Yes. But this is unprecedented. And the natural reaction to that is resistance, is defense. If you attack my home and you kill my kids and you rape my women, I will have to retaliate and defend myself. It is but natural.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. Wright, let's talk about the actions of the new extremist Israeli cabinet at just a few weeks in. There was a visit by the fascist minister Itamar Ben-Gavir to the Nafa prison with the aim of harassing Palestinian prisoners there. Also, the office of the new Israeli prime minister announced financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority in their appeal, in response rather to their appeal at the ICJ. What are the Israelis trying to achieve with these actions? Hamas says that the extremist occupation government is planning a dangerous escalation.
I caught part of the question with regards to the activities of Itamar Ben-Gvir. Itamar Ben-Gvir has been an extremist. He is viewed so far off the political pale that even Israelis themselves consider him an extremist. Itamar Ben-Gvir's sole purpose is to declare a war against the Palestinians. He spoke about this even before he was elected into office. He said that he was looking to do a complete annexation of the Palestinian territories. These actions of incitement, of clear provocation, is to spark a war. There is a system that is currently running within Israel where they believe that the previous administrations had been too weak, had been too soft, and that they need to take the Palestinians head on. The problem is that the military advisors and administration of Israel does not concur with these political heads or these extremists in any manner or form. What they are advising is that any type of military confrontation now, particularly around the powder keg, the trigger, Masjid al-Aqsa, Bayt al-Maqdis, will spell the end of Israel. This is their own analysis, their own assessment. In fact, a key think tank within Israel, INSS, has just run a simulation simulating an eruption of violence around Haram al-Sharif. So what you are seeing is an attempt to try and push Israel to this point of no return. However, the calculation between the political movement as well as the calculation between the military aspects of Israel is vastly different. And I do believe, as I've said before, is that we are heading towards an inevitable end. Even if you look at the other aspect, the international law aspect, we are seeing repetitive victories by the Palestinians in pushing Israel towards accountability. You see the ICJ recently being asked by the United Nations by a vote in that favor to give an advisory opinion about the occupation and annexation. We see Israel's facing the possibility of a case of war crimes at the ICJ. These are good signs. However, I believe that with every international law step, it has to be coupled with military action, and this is what we're seeing on the ground. The Palestinians are resisting, and they are resisting fiercely, and this is bringing the Israeli regime to its knees, much like it did in South Africa. It was the armed resistance as well as other soft power systems.
Mohsen Avi, more land confiscations and evictions are being carried out by the Israelis, as pointed out numerous times. Under international law, the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population it occupies. Human Rights Watch has said Israel's policies amount to apartheid and crimes against humanity. Why are these policies continuing?
Well, as the brother also mentioned, these are all pressure tactics. How do you ensure that your power is through violence when you are an entity like the Zionist regime? The only option that you have, the only way for you to stay in power is through oppression, is by exerting illegal power. And now, as the brother mentioned, that yes, international courts, international bodies are taking notice of these actions, but to what extent? To what extent? Mere words will not bring about a change within the lives of the Palestinians, or they will not decrease the atrocities committed by the Israeli regime. The United Nations recently mentioned, and they said that punitive demolitions are a form of collective punishment. That's what the United Nations said, and they said that they are illegal and under international law as to target the families of the perpetrator. So when more than one family is affected, Military Order 1797 by the Zionist entity is what conducts these demolitions. They justify the demolitions through that military order. But it is quite true that it is abused. It is illegal in the first place, and it is abused. It is constantly abused. The EU has taken notice of that. The United Nations has taken notice of this. But to what extent? What can we do with these notices until and unless they don't place sanctions on the Zionist regime? Nothing can happen, but we believe the least that the UN can do, the least that the international courts can do, is to place sanctions on the Zionist regime. But we believe in the one-state solution, which on the land of Palestine, Jews, Christians, Muslims, and anyone of any denomination can live respectfully and in peace. Whereas it is quite clear that the Zionist regime wants the exact opposite.
Mr. Mayet, in Johannesburg, on the same topic, what are the Israelis achieving with its land grab policy? Apart from Judaization of Palestinian land, are the Israelis also deliberately sabotaging any prospects of an independent Palestinian state in the future?
Definitely. The Israeli plan at the moment is to effectively evict the Palestinians and force them into the surrounding territories. There was a discussion recently on the Washington Institute where it was posed as a question that the Egyptians should take custodianship of Gaza, and this is a possible option that could be looked at to defuse the tension. This gives you an indication of the Israeli plan. Ehud Barak and Tzipi Livni had said at a previous conference, an IDC Heslia conference, that Israel is now facing a very clear choice, and this was approximately 4 to 5 years ago. They said that Israel is facing the choice of being a Jewish state or a Jewish democratic state, and if it chooses to be a Jewish state, it will become an apartheid state. What we are seeing is that this train is running headlong towards apartheid in the most open and most undiluted form. What you are seeing right now is that Israel is trying to create facts on the ground in the hope of swallowing the Palestinians. In fact, the Israeli High Court is quoted to have said that civilian Jewish presence in part is part of the regional security doctrine of the area for the West Bank. This shows you that even the justice enforcers, as we would like to look the court, look at the courts as, are just as corrupt and are enforcing the principles of apartheid. So yes, Israel is trying to create facts on the ground. What they are unaware of is that the fact is that you are heading towards a one state, and they do not have a demographic majority, nor do they have the military prowess to deal with the resistance that has been put up by the Palestinians. You can see how they've lost repetitive military engagements, and they are unable to stem the tide of resistance within the West Bank, despite having full and maximum control over it. Despite having the PA as the enforcers, they cannot stem the tide of resistance. And this is something that they need to acknowledge, understand, recognize, and realize that you cannot continue with this oppression. The time is limited.
Mr. Nahvi, we're almost out of time. We have maybe less than a minute if you want to add any closing comments to the program.
Yes. It is quite clear that Israel is as weak as a spider's web. It has never been this weak before. We are truly seeing the end of the Zionist regime. Alhamdulillah, because of Shahid Qasem Soleimani, the IRGC, and the resistance forces, they have proven that they are independent in their military capabilities, and they are ready to face any kind of oppression from the Zionist regime. They have proven themselves time and time again. Hezbollah has defeated the Zionist regime on many fronts, 2000, 2006, and also their very proxy, which is ISIS, in Syria and in Iraq. The resistance forces are ready
very well
to face the Zionist entity.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Human rights activist Mohsen Nahvi joining us from Houston, Texas. And thanks to attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmed Maye joining us from Johannesburg. A special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
While the U.S. beats on drums of human rights violations in other countries, it has less care about the situation of women and mothers in the U.S. A new study has revealed that during pandemic, mothers in the U.S. were especially likely to report high levels of stress during the public health crisis if they experienced major disruptions to their daily lives at work, their children's schools, or in their interactions with their communities. Due to a variety of factors, researchers said mothers may be particularly susceptible to psychological stress effects from the COVID-19 pandemic. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote in this regard, a study by the National Institute of Health in the first 16 months of the coronavirus pandemic found that mothers in the U.S. were especially likely to report high levels of stress during the public health crisis if they experienced major disruptions to their daily lives at work, their children's schools, or in their interactions with their communities, as the majority of people surveyed said they did. The NIH Environmental Influences on Child Health Outcomes, ECHO program, surveyed more than 11,000 mothers between April 2020 and August 2021, the largest study to date regarding how mothers experienced the pandemic. More than 8,400 respondents reported that their lives had changed dramatically after the World Health Organization declared the worldwide coronavirus outbreak, a pandemic in mid-March 2020, and schools and businesses across the U.S. and the planet were forced to close, furlough or lay off workers, and shift to remote-only models, along with other sweeping changes to daily life. According to lead study author Theresa Bastain, Associate Professor of Clinical Population and Public Health Sciences at the Keck School of Medicine of University of Southern California, researchers chose to examine the effects of the pandemic on the mental health of mothers because previous research has described how they took on much of the burden caused by the pandemic-linked changes to the economy and education system. Mothers suffered a large share of the income and job losses and shouldered much of the responsibility of childcare and homeschooling children, the school said in a press release. For example, Pew Research reported in October that for mothers whose youngest child was between the ages of 5 and 12, the average time they spent on secondary childcare, supervising children while doing other activities such as working, increased by about 2.5 hours between 2019 and 2020, going from 5.8 hours per day to 8.2 hours. For fathers, this type of childcare increased by 1.2 hours between 2019 and 2020. In September 2020, Pew also reported that mothers were more than three times as likely as fathers to have lost their jobs in the first months of the pandemic. Mothers may be particularly susceptible to psychological stress effects from COVID-19 pandemic, reads the new study, which was published recently in JAMA Network Open. School closures impact working mothers, leading to loss of income and complementary meals in school settings. Unexpected child care expenses and gaps in adequate technology and quiet space for remote learning. The study continues, it is critical to understand the associations between pandemic hardships and mental health of U.S. mothers. The researchers questioned mothers about how much their daily lives changed as a result of the pandemic, particularly about whether they began working remotely, became more isolated due to social distancing guidelines, had less access to healthcare, or got less physical exercise. They also asked respondents if they had shown signs of acute stress disorder, defined as symptoms that arise after or during an event that threatens one's life or the life of a person's loved ones, including anxiety, negative moods, disassociation, avoidance, and sleepiness. Mothers who reported high levels of pandemic-related disruptions were more likely to report such symptoms, according to the study. It really came down to change, and those mothers whose lives carried on much as they normally had did not report as much stress, said Bastian, adding it was the mothers who had big disruptions who reported the higher levels of stress. Although low-income people and communities of color bore the brunt of the pandemic in numerous ways, with studies showing that Black Americans were more likely to be hospitalized for COVID-19 infections and that socioeconomic factors were linked to the increased odds that Black and Hispanic people test positive for the disease, the study published recently showed that mothers with incomes that were higher than $30,000 were more likely to show signs of stress. The high change cluster contained 8,412 mothers and was characterized by higher incomes, higher education, and higher cohabitation. The high change cluster was more likely to report financial concerns as a source of stress. 3,008 participants, about 35.76% versus 925 participants, about 30.22%, and had a higher proportion of white mothers. 5,539 participants, 65.85% versus 1,656 participants, 54.10%. Both clusters had similar distributions of Latino and Hispanic participants. Lower income people who were surveyed were more likely to have jobs in which they did not have the ability to work remotely, noted the researchers, putting them at greater risk for infection. However, along with the privilege of working remotely and being able to quarantine away from other household members, considerable disruption in day-to-day life was also experienced in the high change cluster, including greater social isolation from family, friends, and colleagues, who are important sources of social support when confronted with a major traumatic life event, reads the study, adding, a surprising result was that mothers in the low change cluster reported high post-traumatic stress when they spent more time with family. Spending greater time with family might be stressful for mothers with lower socioeconomic advantage, the study continues, especially if they reside in smaller homes where they may be unable to quarantine away from family members. For mothers across socioeconomic and racial groups, the study shows that we need to think about traumatic experiences like natural disasters, pandemics, or mass shootings more historically. There is a wide range of hardships that women experience from these events that we need to understand, the expert said, adding, so we can protect people from long-term effects.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.